I would like to raise with you today is the question whether everybody has a right to health or not. Whether everybody has a right to health. Health. Health, yes. It's the opposite of illness. Health. H-E-A-L-T-H. Whether everybody has a right to health or not.
Is that like asking whether everyone has a right to a gift?
Well, you see, that's essentially my question, and I myself do not have an answer. I lean towards a certain answer, but it's a big question in my mind whether everybody has a right to health or not. Now, in medical centers and hospitals, in schools of nursing, in medical schools, this is a great slogan, the right to health. Not only there, but also in the political discussions of our nation. This is a big theme. You remember that Nixon, before he had left the presidency, had set up his own program for a national health insurance program. And presidents today and administrations can no longer avoid the issue. It is a big national issue. Whether the nation has an obligation to guarantee health for everyone. And of course, we must understand that this theme fits into the whole debate about rights, human rights. We talk today a great deal about rights, but rights to jobs, rights to free speech, rights to education. We seem to think that we have rights for almost everything. And in that context, there is also the question whether we have a right to health.
Excuse me, this would then be equating health with medical attention.
That's right.
Yes. I'm confused by health or health care. That seems to me it's quite a difference.
Oh yes, sure. Sure.
Are you meaning health or health care?
Well, those people who say that we have a right to health imply that there should be some kind of national health care program so that if I get ill, or if I get ill, I can get, even with limited financial resources, the kind of attention that I need, even though it may be very expensive. So in a broader sense, the issue that I'm raising here is the issue of triage, as it is said in English. And I would like to give you as much time to debate the issue as possible. On the other hand, I would also like to mention a few things, maybe I should do that first, a few things of the intricacy of the debate. The word triage, or triage as it is said in English, arose out of the First World War. In the French military language, this word implies, I don't know the exact translation, I'm sorry about that, but the word implies that a general has a right to sacrifice a few soldiers so that many could be saved. Another slogan in medical ethics to characterize the situation is the so-called lifeboat ethic. The lifeboat ethic. Because in the lifeboat situation, it may be necessary to sacrifice a few in order to save the whole boat. And I can give you a historical illustration. In the 19-teens, 1915 or 16, a ship sank off the Atlantic coast, an American ship. And a crew and a few other members of the ship went into a lifeboat. And there were too many in the lifeboat. And the skipper made the decision that the weakest should be thrown overboard, because if they would not be thrown overboard, everybody would vanish. It was a very high sea, and it was indeed a very difficult situation, and they needed the strength, they needed the strongest to save themselves. Otherwise, nobody would be saved at all. And they did come to shore, and of course, the issue became public, and a trial was held, and they were found guilty of manslaughter or something like that. In other words, the court decided against them, not in their favor. And that case has become a famous case to illustrate the so-called lifeboat ethic, or the issue of triage in medical ethics. If not all can be saved, then perhaps a few should perish, so that a few others can survive. Shall everybody pay a rather high fee? Medical fees become more and more expensive for medical treatment. Also, more and more diseases seem to be discovered. We don't only conquer diseases, but we also discover new ones. And that is, I think, a major problem. The question is whether a nation can indeed afford the guarantee to everyone health care. I should also say that my own opinion has changed slightly. I have always been in favor of a national health care program, because in Europe there are such programs and they have worked quite well until the recent recession. They no longer work so well now, because now, especially in England, but also in West Germany, for example, where we come from, the national health care program is simply becoming too expensive. My opinion has become a little bit less rigid now. I was always very much in favor of a national healthcare program, but now I am no longer so certain, because I'm beginning to realize that it may simply be too expensive. Now, I would like to illustrate to you, if you would want to debate the issue right now and present your opinions, I would be very happy about that. But we could illustrate the issue on the kidney dialysis problem, which is today no longer quite such a problem, because we have invented better kidney machines, which are more readily accessible to the general public. But I think that this would be a good case to illustrate the problem. In the early 60s, kidney machines were developed, and it became possible to give kidney dialysis machines to those who needed them. You know that the human body has two kidneys, and sometimes one fails, sometimes both fail. And then it is necessary by modern medical to provide the kind of medical treatment that is necessary for their condition to prevent such people from dying. The kidneys purify the blood, and if the kidneys no longer function, then the organism would die. But today it is possible through kidney machines to clean the blood. And people who have malfunctioning or no longer functioning kidneys can go to medical centers and have their blood cleaned. Indeed, it is possible today for them to take kidney machines home into their house and to do home dialysis. That is the technical term for the washing of the blood, as it is called. In 1968, I was visiting with my teacher Helmut Thielicke the medical center in Houston. And there we saw, among other things, a French politician who had been flown in from France to have his blood cleaned, to have his blood washed out, to be put on a kidney machine. We saw him there, we exchanged a few words with him, and we saw the rather complicated, huge kidney machine, which looks somewhat like a washing machine, round and about the size of a washing machine, and you could see the blood flowing through the machine. I'm sure that not very far away from the hospital there were patients right in Houston who needed kidney machines but couldn't get them. Why couldn't they get them? That's a good question. A famous French politician was flown in from France to have his blood washed, to have kidney dialysis, whereas some poor person about whom nobody knows, who perhaps doesn't even have enough money to go to a physician, cannot have the necessary treatment in the hospital which is right close by. Well, that's the kind of system that we live in right now. I wondered about that.
Did you know for sure that there were people at Houston who had that problem? Because in most states, that isn't true. that through the social welfare system in almost every state, if there is anybody who has to see a physician, they are able to see a physician through the social health agencies. And they may not be able to afford dialysis for all the people, but they at least would have been able to see a physician.
But that is the question, whether they could also get the dialysis.
So the point is not whether they could see a physician,
no,
but whether the social welfare agencies could afford the dialysis.
Right.
Okay. Just that's, to make that clear.
Yeah. Now, I must add, now that is possible. I want the people who do not know too much about this, now this is possible. Through a Supreme Court ruling of a couple of years ago, it is now possible for everyone to, at public expense, to have the kind of dialysis that is necessary. Mm-hmm. Also, I must say once more, I've said this just a minute ago, that the problem is no longer now the same problem, because kidney machines are now much more readily available. We have very different kidney machines now. We have kidney machines that you can practically carry around with you. There are filters. I've been told this very rudimentarily, but there are certain filters which are disposable filters. And in other words, technology has moved ahead a great deal, and it is no longer the problem now that it used to be only a few years ago. But it is a good, it's a good way to illustrate the basic problem. And for that reason, I'm bringing it up.
Bio-Rad makes such machine, and it works quite well on animals. But are you familiar with the work where Hans and Atkins are doing some of it on animals, where they take a portion of the small intestine and tie it off, and it's already got its blood supply and all this coming, and run a solution through and out of the body, and it seems to work quite well on dogs. Are you familiar with
that? No, I have not heard of that.
You haven't heard of it?
No.
It's these two guys are a little bit wild on experimenting, and they get in trouble with the people who think you shouldn't be so cruel to animals.
Yes.
But the blood supply comes, and then it works backwards from the digestive process, and they look the blood that comes through the small intestine to feed its waste into the intestine and wash it on out.
Yes.
It seems to work. I don't know whether this is a coming thing or not. If
yes,
you are, maybe you can get your own dialysis machine made and have it right with you. You don't certainly need all of your small intestines.
That's right. Uh-huh. No, I have not heard of that, but short of that, I suppose the newer machines that some speak of in a couple of years having, some speak of in a couple of years the availability of machines that you clip onto your belt. This is, of course, something else than what you're talking about, but I suppose that development is still a little bit...
It's very...
Experimental.
Experimental,
yeah.
But seems to work quite well on some adults.
No. I would like us always to keep in mind now the basic theme. Does everyone have a right to health care, if you want to specify the issue in that sense? Does everybody have a right to health care, or in a more simple way, does everybody have a right to health? That, I think, is the basic question. And from there, another question develops, the question of triage. I assume, when I raise the issue of triage, as it is said in English, that it is impossible for society to pay for all the health care that might be necessary for everyone. So that we must make a decision on what kind of health care to provide to whom, and who's going to pay for that health care. I can give you another illustration. A couple of years after, we had seen this French politician in the Houston Medical Center in 1968. A couple of years after that, a television documentary appeared, made by Daniel Shaw, I believe, and the film was called Don't Get Sick in America. And among other things, it showed a Belgian who had come to California, a Belgian technician who had come to California, settled there, had bought a house, had a very well-paying job, part of the European brain drain, and then he got very bad kidney problems, and he couldn't pay for it anymore. He couldn't pay for the dialysis. And because, as a Belgian citizen, they have a kind of health insurance program where former citizens are capable of receiving or receiving the benefits of the national health care program, he went back. He went back to Belgium. He gave up his job because in Belgium he could have the kind of health care that he needed, whereas in California he could not. But that was a little bit later, because at that time in Europe they had had the same machines that they had had in the United States. Again, the basic question is, does everyone have a right to health care? I would like to raise that question. To me, that is not obvious. To me, that's not obvious. Let me tell you what my opinion is. At least let me attempt to tell it, because I'm not sure that whether I'm also clear in my opinion. I am thinking of two statements right now. One by the Old Testament theologian Gerhard von Rath, who had made clear to me the relation between freedom and law, between moral freedom and the law. And he writes about this in the theology of the Old Testament in his statements on the Decalogue. He said, in the Old Testament, God gave us laws, only minimal laws, so that within the boundaries of those laws we could be free, but this implies moral engagement. And from here, I'm thinking of another statement that John Kennedy made, a statement that said, don't think of what your country can do for you, but think of what you can do for your country. And the whole issue of rights seems to always imply that I am the center of attention of everything, and that everybody should pay so that I'm being taken care of. And it forgets that morality really always precedes legality, I think. We always say that certain laws should be established, for example, in this instance, laws that make it possible for my health to be guaranteed. Certain laws should be established so that I can live the kind of life that I would like to live. And I'm not sure whether it should be that way. I think maybe it should be the other way around. That we shouldn't always attempt to set up laws for my own benefits or for my own freedom to be guaranteed, my own health to be guaranteed, my own education to be guaranteed. Maybe it should be the other way around, but it's just a question that I'm asking.
I've been wondering if there has been an increase in the number of men and women who want to be physicians. If we're going to have national health care, we're going to need more doctors. Has there been an increase?
Well, as far as I know, I'm not so knowledgeable about the statistics, but as far as I know, the American Medical Association continues to be extremely restrictive. And that is the major impediment to more physicians being available, or more positions in medical schools. Pardon me?
I don't think that's entirely true. Mm-hmm. I know in the field of specialty mm-hmm. training, most schools are cutting back on specialty training, not because
yes.
the American Medical Association is saying so,
I see.
But because the federal government has for years been subsidizing schools,
I see.
And they are now withdrawing the subsidization,
I see.
And the schools are being forced to cut back on who they can put through.
I see.
I don't know about general.
I know that most of those who go in remit,
mm-hmm.
out of thousands,
mm-hmm.
there might be three lucky to get into medical school.
Yes.
And right now it's of course opening for Negroes and women,
yes.
which they want to balance out.
That's right.
But I do know that it is very hard for a boy to get into medical
yes.
school.
Do you disagree with that?
I don't think it's three out of a thousand.
No.
I heard it was
mm-hmm.
a bit like
maybe a couple
yeah.
more.
Yes.
It's more like half or so in May.
500 out of 1,000?
Oh.
No.
In Minnesota, it's about 1 out of 10.
Not in California.
It's
one
because
of
the number of places in the
mm-hmm.
school, but they
yeah.
have started new and not male. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Not in California.
But I think it's because they don't have the facilities to take care of them.
Yes, right, there's no facilities.
Right.
There might be the bill.
It costs, what does it cost now? In the Albany Medical Center, some medical students told me it costs
$7,000
a year.
But that's only a part of, very small.
That's only a
fraction
part.
Of the cost of
yeah.
what the real cost.
Yeah.
But in answer to this lady over here, I don't think that the problem is the number of men and women who want to go into the field. It's the facilities to educate them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I assumed the statement or the question to be that.
She said, are there enough men and women who are interested?
Oh, yeah. There are many, many applicants. Oh, everybody wants to get into medical school.
University yeah. of in Duluth, they're making a medical center now, a brand new one.
Yes.
Where they're going to, and they're not stressing specialized, they're stressing more like a country doctor, the one that goes in the home, general practitioner.
Yes, that is a
specialized now.
Yes, there is a movement.
The small communities can't stand it. There are enough people there for a specialized person. We want more of the country type doctors.
Well, that, if I understand it correctly, there are two movements. The move towards specialization cannot be impeded. That continues, I think. But there is another movement, precisely because of the problem that, or some of the problems that we are raising here, to go contrary to that. At a conference where I was in Chateau de Bossy in 1968, also on medical ethics, I met a professor of general practicing, I guess you would have to call it, this was a new chair that was established in some Belgian university. It is a new movement, if I understand it correctly, in the medical education to develop the field of general practicing.
In the North Wisconsin, we have too many of these small communities, just like our Iron River and Glidden and Melanola. They can stand one doctor that is general, but if you need specialization, then they send you to Madison or to Mayo or whatever like
yes.
that. But it's sometimes we just need the general, because
yes.
we don't need a specialist to treat a foot or
yes.
something of that,
yes.
of that nature.
That's right.
Like some just little cuts or something like that.
Yes.
We need just a general one.
Yes. Barbara, you had your hand up some time ago.
Oh, I was just going to comment about the number of students that are interested in med school and those that get in. I think statistics could be very misleading because as freshmen, we have many, many students that start out as pre-med. But along the way, somewhere from junior or senior, they realize I don't have a 4-point average. The probability of getting in is virtually nil, and so they, at that point, perhaps their senior year, switch into something else, realizing that they probably are not going to make it.
Yeah. Well, what's the point? I mean, still the point is that the medical schools are extremely restrictive, and that there are many applicants. I guess your point would be that if medical school would be less restrictive, then actually those who want to study medicine would actually become physicians. Yes. And my question has always been, do we need that kind of high average? Do we need those kinds of that kind of students that is very capable of, extremely capable of retaining book knowledge? You know, I mean, that's what you need. Yes, book knowledge. You need to learn by rote in medical school. That's what I understand. And we are fostering encyclopedias of knowledge. But not necessarily good physicians, I think. Physicians have told me this themselves. Dr. Porter at the Albany Medical Center, for example, the chairman of pediatrics, and many others. And they see the great need of medical ethics. Medical students themselves see the great need of the introduction of this kind of an element into the medical school curriculum. But the problem is that the whole medical education is geared towards this kind of by rote learning, and not necessarily for patient care, and for compassionate care. Yes?
I understand there's a kind of rebellion against this too, that in terms that there's a kind of do-it-yourself religion
yes.
In terms of healing, and people are saying,
yes.
hey, you know, there's a bureaucracy that's saying you've got to see your doctor, get an annual checkup, and this. You don't need an annual checkup. You don't
yes.
need a lot of other things. You
yes.
can do it yourself.
Yes.
And Ivan Illich, I understand, has written a book on the medical nemesis, where he really attacks this whole system of medical care and says it's just self-perpetuating.
Yes, that's right.
And teaching us to be dependent rather than taking care of ourselves.
That's right. Yes, we are all slightly hypochondriac because we love our illness. Because
I have a right to my illness. It serves me a lot of purposes because
yes.
I can get out of a lot of things when I'm sick.
That's right.
What right do you have to say that I'm supposed to be healthy?
That's right. Okay. Wonderful, yes.
How are you going to know you have high blood pressure unless you get medical checkup?
I hear that there is a nursing home in California where you can, where there are, instead of parking meters, there are blood pressure things, and you just, you know, you pull up with your car and you check your own blood pressure. I think it's not too difficult to take your own blood pressure.
Well, there are a lot of other tests, too, that you can't do.
Sure, sure.
Stopping
the point is well taken. Sure.
Well, I wanted to get back to what you were talking about. Morality should come before legality.
Yep.
And that implies choice, which
yes.
is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we're discussing today, and most of us probably are very healthy here, but we're discussing a child that's born with diabetes or a heart problem
mm-hmm.
or somebody who has an illness. Do they have no control or no choice
yes.
over what they were born with or developed through their life. I'm not discussing at this point the dope addict or the alcoholic or the person who through choice possibly acquired many illnesses, and maybe they didn't really have a choice to. That's kind of another thing. But what I think is important for us in this discussion is not to lose sight of, are we talking about a person that does not have control, and do they have the right to help as much as is possible within the parameters of what they're born with?
Mm-hmm.
An affliction of some
mm-hmm.
kind, a painful.
Mm-hmm.
As polio was before that.
Yes, a good example, I asked my wife whether she knew enough about this, but a good example of an outrageous expense for very, very few would be the barium chamber. The hyperbaric chamber, it's called. It's a chamber where the atmospheric pressure is increased manifold to eliminate some kind of disorder. Very few. Those children that are born with a certain disorder can survive only with that kind of treatment, but there are only very few. But a hyperbaric chamber in a hospital is very expensive. I don't know exactly the condition. Maybe somebody knows exactly the condition that can be treated with this. Those children cannot certainly, you know, they can't do anything about being born with that disorder. But so it's not a matter of their choice.
So that's what we're really discussing here, though, isn't it? Do they have
that's
the right?
Right. That's right.
You know, and where are you going to draw the line?
That's right.
Are you going to say if they're, huge illness like diabetes, we're going to treat everybody with diabetes, that's triaging.
Yes.
But you have three people with hyperbaric problems, and
yes.
then we aren't going to treat them and let them die.
That's right.
And so
that's right.
That's really what,
exactly.
what we
that's exactly the That's exactly the problem. Do we have as a society the obligation to treat everyone that has no choice about being born with a certain affliction? Or that develops a certain affliction later about which he can do nothing. Now, the problem is really slightly more complicated because, in fact, the disorders with which you are born are relatively little, if I understand it. I think the disorders which you develop later on, due also to unhealthy living, are outweighing the others. Heart problems, for example, I think are largely due to unhealthy living and... preventive medicine therefore becomes a great issue, which gets us back to to some kind of national health care program. Because once you have a national health care program, then, or maybe HMOs, which are health maintenance organizations, HMOs is one of the models of healthcare, of a healthcare program being debated in order to circumvent some of the problems which are associated with the national healthcare program as European nations have it. And the big advantage of either a national health insurance program or an HMO would be that you could practice preventive medicine and catch the disorder before it becomes impossible to treat or before it becomes outrageously expensive to treat it.
I wonder too if it isn't both interesting and significant to set all of this in a somewhat wider context. Is it right, for example, for me, morally speaking, to spend $100,000, let's say, to save the life of my child,
mm-hmm.
when the same $100,000 might save the lives of hundreds of children
That's right.
in some other part of the world?
That's right.
If it is my child, I think I
That's right.
probably know what I would try to do with that,
yes.
but
yes.
it is a very significant question.
Yes, the Hastings Center, with whom I work in Hastings-on-Hudson, conducted one of its annual meetings in Mexico City a couple of years ago. And in order to get some kind of a different perspective on the ethical issues that we are concerned with. And when the Hastings Center got there, I was in Europe at that time, so I couldn't attend that meeting. But I was told later on that the Mexican physicians said, look, we can't really be troubled by your hair-splitting ethical issues about human dignity and that kind of thing. We have even the most rudimentary medical problems to attend to. There are masses and masses of people that we can't even reach. For that reason, we can't be concerned with whether consent forms are properly signed and whether there's free and informed consent and about such issues. We have simply to treat and to try to treat as best as we can the many afflictions that exist. Yes, quite correct. In order to get a little bit more advanced, maybe I should mention that there are, in my reading, I have come across three basic positions here. Namely, Kahn is a Roman Catholic theologian, C-A-H-N. He is written about in Ramsey's book on Patient as Person. I did not read Kahn's essay myself, but Ramsey's description of his position. Kahn has a very interesting position. He said, if not all can be saved, all should perish, in the lifeboat ethic. If not all can be saved, all should perish. For example, in the kidney dialysis situation, you cannot really decide to choose this one rather than that one of the 10. You know, so supposing there could be only one patient for out of 10 who need a dialysis. You must choose one out of 10 who need it because you have only one machine for every 10 patients that need it. Today, in present day terms, we could say that the availability of organs, of transplants, kidneys, is very minimal. We need many, many more kidneys than we have for transplantation purposes. So we could change the same issue into modern terms by saying that there are only a few kidneys for many, many who need them. That's a very interesting position by Kahn, and most people would reject it, as I would too. But I would like to explain to you why Kahn thinks that way. He tells himself that each human life is, before the eyes of God, so valuable, ultimately valuable, that it is not in the power of any man to decide whether this or that life is more valuable. You will inevitably get into that kind of a decision that is having to decide which life is more valuable when you must choose which life should be saved and which not. And I think that's an honorable position. Kahn simply says that the human reason is not comparable to God. In God's eyes, we must assume that every life is equally valuable because Jesus Christ died for all mankind. Therefore, we cannot make as human beings the choice. We cannot, with our human reason, intrude on an area in which God can only decide. And therefore, if not all can be saved, all shall perish. A very hard position, I think. Now, Ramsey says, let me present Joseph Fletcher's position first. Joseph Fletcher, you remember, has written also, I think, in the 60s, a very famous book by now called Situation Ethics. Joseph Fletcher is a theologian, an Episcopalian theologian, and in a certain way, he's the grandfather of medical ethics by now. He, as a situation theologian, is coming out of the utilitarian position. And the utilitarian position, of course, would say the greatest good to the greatest number. And when you hear Joseph Fletcher talk, he always talks about numbers. He talks about the triage situation in the classical sense. Sacrifice a few so that many could be saved. The ultimate value of each individual life cannot be taken into consideration in the context of Joseph Fletcher's position. But rather, he says, all the many others, supposing you need to sacrifice a few in the lifeboat ethic so that many could be saved, or in the army situation, or in the French World War, in the French army in the First World War. He says, all those many who are saved are ultimately valuable before the eyes of God too. So you must think in terms of numbers. For me, a rather unacceptable position. And then, finally, there is Ramsey's position. I think these are the three basic alternatives. Ramsey opts for a lottery system. At the time when the kidney dialysis debate emerged in the late 60s, maybe the middle 60s already, the leading medical center, I think, in Seattle, set up a committee to decide who should get the machine. And there were on the committee various people from various walks of life to decide whether the mother of five should get the dialysis, or whether the engineer, or whether the coal miner, or whether the bum, the city bum, should get the dialysis. Now, Ramsey discusses all of this in his book, Patient Assessment, and Ramsey opts for a lottery system. He said, yes, Kahn is quite correct. Before the eyes of God, everyone is equal. The bum is just as valuable as the physician. We don't know. We are not going to make that judgment. So, if only one person out of 10 can get a kidney machine, then we are going to have to draw lots. And chance is going to substitute for God's decision. We don't know how God would choose. But the chance system, therefore, is the most just kind of system that we can devise with our limited human rationality, not intruding on God's judgment. That's the way Ramsey solves the issue, and I personally would also opt for Ramsey's position. Yes, Lord?
We could do that in all cases. That seems to me really an abdication of judgment altogether. And suppose, again, think of these illustrations. If a group is lost in the wilderness and they have one boat or something, and there are 10 people and only 8 can get on the boat, and only one is the guide.
Yes.
Without the guide, they cannot get out. Then you cast lots, and the lot falls. The guide has to stay behind. That is absurd. The guide must go, or they will all perish. And it seems to me that there are ways in which one cannot just abdicate your decision making and say we leave it all to chance.
You're quite right. Ramsey modifies his position slightly. He says that now again, medically speaking, I'm not too knowledgeable here, but. He says that certain people who have a better chance, who have less of a chance, should be eliminated. Children under a certain age, for example, would, even though they would be, they would have constant dialysis, would have a very, or at least a significantly reduced chance of survival, or of long-term survival. And also older people over a certain age, I'm not quite sure whether that's correct, or people with certain illnesses, with diabetes, for example. This makes the whole thing more complicated, but he says that only, say, people with unequal chance should be entered into this kind of lottery.
He would not then say, for take other examples, I just go for something, that you have a researcher who may be near a breakthrough on cancer, and you have the town bum who has, you know, he would not, those factors would never enter in. If it falls to take the choice between the man working on the cancer research and the town bum.
If they have medically the same chance, Ramsey says that you must draw a lot. Because the researcher could use his research, who knows, for very evil purposes. Maybe he's developing the atomic bomb, who knows?
Yes, but once make all those choices, it seems to me that the last time they cast lots was when they were looking for that guy to replace Judas, and we never heard of him again. And it seems to me that almost gets the whole thing almost in the realm of kind of gambling and this abdication of judgment and personal responsibility. I've not studied all these things very carefully.
It's quite typical.
I think I would go with Fletcher more.
Incidentally, it's quite typical for Paul Ramsey to argue that way. He says, as I said earlier here in this forum, he says that human reason counts for nothing. And maybe we should indeed, his theology says exactly that, human reason counts for nothing. And maybe as Christians we can't afford to have that kind of position. Just wanted to interject that. But, I have all along identified myself with Ramsey's position because I just can't see Joseph Fletcher's position, for example, or Kahn's position. Kahn's position I have to reject because human reason needs to, you must make, human reason tells you, or even Christian compassion tells you, you must do something. You can't simply refrain from doing anything, as Kahn...
but his point may be that humans can rise to great heights if they say we either all go out of this wilderness together or we all stay here and die. And people will rise to that occasion.
Yes.
And I could imagine that concept in certain... I could go with that in unless it was the most desperate and dire of straits, I believe that would be applicable.
Yes. I always try to illustrate Kant's position to students who just, you know, who can't see that at all, as I can't really ultimately, but I try to illustrate it with a mother who may have to make a decision between, say, 3 or 4 children, which one to save. If I would be in the poor mother's position, I don't think I could make that decision. I would have to say, leave it up to God, or let somebody else make the decision, but I can't. I would rather that all perish, but please don't let me make that decision, because I love all children equally, and I cannot doom one to death. You know,
Would you not be grateful at the end and say it's somebody else
that's
would
right.
make the decision?
That's right.
And that
that's
four
right.
of the 5 children were saved out of the fire or whatever it may be.
Yes.
Or if the child itself asked to not be saved.
Yes.
That right. could be too. A child has, you know, if it's old enough and will say, I want to have the other one.
I have a question,
yes,
not deciding between the 2 children in a way, but one of the big controversies we've had in Minnesota recently is the pro-life group versus, for instance, a child born before they are viable. And so then you save the child and it costs at least $100,000 per child.
Yes.
And it has a high chance of being handicapped, being blind, deaf, or, you know, multiple handicaps. And now I'm not talking about, you know, if you have insurance and all this. I'm talking about, this is the problem with welfare mothers. Probably unmarried welfare mothers is what they're talking about. I don't know. The pro-life group says everybody has a right to this. And then some people say, but there is a limit to the amount of money that even the taxpayers can afford.
Yes.
Okay, that's one of the big controversies that has been going around.
Yes, Fletcher would say, yes, indeed, the numbers are very important, and you just have to make some kind of a decision. And Ramsey would say, no, the life is ultimately valuable before God, and you must do whatever you can. Or maybe you can't do everything. I have constantly opted for Ramsey's position here, even though his theological basis has become somewhat questionable to me, but or at least I have some questions about it. But I do think that each life is ultimately valuable before God, and we must do whatever we can. Now, what can we do? Maybe we can't afford to spend $100,000 for such preemies. But medical research is also advancing. And maybe it might be possible to eliminate the premature babies, those the multiple handicaps. From year to year, I'm really amazed what kind of progress is being made. What used to be the viable border used to be around 1,000 grams, is that right? 1,000 grams. And then it was 900 grams, then it was 600 grams. It's really amazing, you know, what kind of tiny babies are being saved and are being raised. There was another hand, the gentleman. Go ahead.
It's interesting to me, too. I mean, it's just a personal thing. We're judging the individual. In other words, we're thinking of the ultimate life, and maybe we can come on the other end. Death. Who's most prepared to die? This gets into more than individual thing. It was interesting. At a pastor session, they had 10 such individuals, and you were to mark them in numbers. And it went down to the big preacher who was saving souls all over, down to the prostitute. And it was just amazing to me that the prostitute always ended up on the end. And then the pastor, they're most prepared to die, so give the life, because this life is just small and just, you know, short. We're looking at the life here, and we've got to look maybe at eliminating as the process of who's
ready to
die.
That's right.
Yeah, but if I understand Ramsey correctly, then his question is, who are we to judge over people? And who makes the judgment who should live and who should die? Or who should have certain treatment and who should not? Who are we that we judge that a certain group of people is more worth having treatment than another group?
Aren't we doing that all the time? Every time we go to dinner, we decide the use of food, our use of everything. We are deciding that we will live and we let other people die. And it seems to me that I just have great reservation
respecting, I wouldn't agree with Fletcher or anything either. But that...
That's like having one piece, one pie in Holden Village. Mm-hmm. And the first person comes along and says, well, I'd like to take the whole pie, please. Say, well, I can't decide, so you go ahead, you take it, and then nobody else gets any. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
You mean Ramsey's position?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess I'm too pragmatic. Mm-hmm. You know, you say 10 preemies who may be handicapped and be a tremendous expense. 10 preemies is $1 million. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, boy, what could you do with $1 million for maybe 500,000 children or 20,000 children?
It does cost a great deal. I am not quite sure who pays for such preemies, but I think it is. I think physicians do that. I think hospitals do that. If a preemie is brought in by ambulance, somehow the cost is being paid for. Now it may happen that many such preemies never come to the hospital. Then the hospital doesn't feel responsible. But as soon as it comes in, I think in the hospitals across the whole country, this is so. And you say that it is not pragmatic enough. I guess you're a physician, yes?
Yeah.
Well, you must know then. I mean, this
is what's being paid by the tax-paying public. Mm-hmm. And the tax-paying public is now getting to the point where they're not going to pay that anymore. And they're saying, hey, let's stop this. And so I think there's going to have to be some kind of way of deciding where do the tax dollars go? How far can you go? Mm-hmm. So you've got half the public paying taxes and half living off the taxes the other half pay.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather pay for a premium than the national defense that we're just throwing away too.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And such issues have to be raised, I think. I quite agree with that. But I think that, you know, if you're talking about a physician, if he has a child coming to him to pay a premium, I think it is a responsibility. Now, I have been around physicians long enough to understand also that this kind of reasonableness about which we have been talking is practiced constantly. You are constantly raising the question, how much more can we do, how much more should I do?
I think it comes in more, it's not so much the preemie as it is the, you've got 5 beds in a coronary care unit and you've got another one that comes in, and mm-hmm. you've got somebody you know that he's not going to live according to all your parameters. Then you take him out and bring another one in. But it's this kind of more of that end of life than a premium.
That's right. I mean, that's a triage situation in the best sense.
Yeah, if you really talk about triage, when it happened in the French army, it would be like you got maybe 100 bottles of blood, and they bring in 15 or 20 soldiers, and one of them, if you treat him, it's going to take 100 bottles of blood. But then you've got 10 or 15 other ones who, well, one needs an operation, he'll need 5 bottles of blood, but he's going to, obviously that's going to be, according to your experience, he'll live if we do that. And there's other ones that have cuts and bruises, that you're more likely to try to use 100 bottles of blood to save 10 than to pour it all away
into one,
person.
Yes.
And I guess you just have to be pragmatic, that's all, because you've got so many resources.
And physicians are pragmatic in that sense, and I don't know what Ramsey would say about that situation. He didn't talk about triage in the original sense of the term, but he addresses himself in the chapter on patient and person, he addresses himself to the kidney dialysis situation. And there he would say equal chances, you see, and that's something else, equal medical chances. And he said, I'm not quite sure whether medically he's correct there, but he says children under 5 would be a poor risk, poor medical risk to get kidney dialysis. Sometimes his medical judgment is not all too good, so I wouldn't know.
I don't think you can't say either way. You can't say Fletcher is right or Ramsey is right, it should be done by lottery, or Kahn is right. I think you have to decide from case to case. You cannot go by lottery then in your example. That would be foolish to do. And so I don't think neither one has the right position. You just have to decide in cases of, in clinical cases, which way
to go.
Well, that's a subtle modification of Fletcher's position. That's why he calls his book Situation Ethics. For me, always theologically, I've asked him this personally once, what is the deciding criterion in the situation, ethical situation? Now, in Ramsey's, on Tillich's, on Karl Barth's ethic, yes, you have always a triggering notion about human dignity. You don't have that in Ramsey. And that's what bothers me about the situation ethics problem. Yes, in Fletcher's situation ethics, you don't have that. There's no criterion. You just look at the situation. And you ask yourself, where's the sufficient cause from the outside? You know, I think there must be some kind of sufficient cause from the outside, not just the pragmatic view of the situation itself, but rather you must have some kind of a notion of human dignity that comes from outside of that situation. That's my question. That's my question over against Fletcher. Even though I certainly agree that you must look at the situation and we must be situationists to a great extent.
Well, the right to health in Western Germany, you have this in the Europe system, and that's getting too expensive. Yep. Since it's getting too expensive, are you now considering who shall not produce these that are not so healthy?
I don't know how the debate is continuing now. I read about it in the New York Times maybe a month ago, that due to the economic recession that they have there also, the excellent healthcare program that they had and from which I have personally benefited is no longer working as well, and it's becoming a little bit too expensive for the state.
Yeah, are they getting ready now to pass laws to avoid these?
That's what
the possibility, yes. When this was extremely high,
yes.
Are they getting ready to decide who,
yes,
shall not have?
Well, I don't think that that any change in the law would exactly tell you, you know, who should not receive a treatment over against somebody else, but rather certain programs would be cut back.
Oh, yes.
And then, you know, it would be up to the physician, he doesn't, or the agency which allocates funds to decide where the funds, you know, and all of a sudden we have a cut in funds. It's very easy for the law to make such decisions. The people at the bottom, you know, will actually have to execute the law.
Right.
For them it is difficult because they see the patients in front of them and they have to make that decision. But that's apparently the trend in Western Germany right now, even though the recession hasn't been as profound there as it has been here. But it has been a marvelous program, I think, the way they had it in West Germany.
Doesn't Canada have a national program?
I think they do, yes. And Mexico too.
Australia too.
We are, well, of course, the United States is backward I look at it as backward. At least that's a term that I've used in social legislation. We've been backward all along. Yes?
This is what happens in a democracy.
Yes?
We,
yes,
have discussion groups and we reach no decision.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Well, I'd like to present a situation that is happening across the country,
yes,
that is very practical, it's not very idealistic, and kind of changes the direction here. But the lady from Duluth spoke of starting a family practice medical school, and that's exactly what South Dakota has done right now. And our first graduating class is just coming up. And the legislature bought this concept with that in mind, that is what we're going to do, is turn out doctors that can practice in the rural areas. We have plenty of doctors in our major cities.
Yes.
No problem.
That's right.
But in the past year, the insurance company that offers malpractice insurance has said they will no longer insure new doctors starting up a single practice.
Yes.
The only way they will insure a new doctor is if he goes into a clinic and comes under the clinic umbrella policy,
yes,
which thwarts our entire medical school.
That's right.
Now, that's pretty frustrating.
It is. Because
we would never have bought a medical school to produce specialists because they never stay in South Dakota.
That's right. Yeah.
Why is there so much trouble with all this medical? Why does it work in Australia and I don't know West Germany, I only know East Germany is working and it's working right.
Oh, East Germany is a very different story. East Germany is so different, you know.
I know.
know.
It's a great expense, you know, but I mean, East Germany is just marvelous.
Haven't had any changes of prices since 63.
For example, yes.
China.
Everybody lives in equal poverty.
I don't know what we're doing. I like that. We live here in equal poverty too, and everybody likes it. What are we fighting about?
Oh, we have great many problems here.
Too many rich people.
For example, what was just mentioned in the cities, everybody, all the physicians want to go to the city. That which is understandable. You want culture too. I think one of the main reasons is that you want to be able to have your free time. If you would be a country doctor, you just would be traveling along all the time. Some are idealistic enough that they do that, and in 10 years they are dead because they work all the time.
Yeah.
Because the physician's vocation is so demanding that you need substitutes, you need alternatives. People get ill all the time. If you have a large group practice, you can afford to take a vacation occasionally or take off a weekend because there's somebody else in your group practice. If you're a solo doctor somewhere out in the woods, then you are all by yourself and you just drive all the time and you are up day and night all the time.
If you had enough doctors, every little town had a doctor, then you wouldn't have that problem so much. Well, there's a comment on this thing about the lawsuit problem and the liability insurance, that we have a friend who is a medical doctor here in the United States, but he is also from Germany, and his home is in Germany, born there, and he maintains, and anything that this is true, or your reaction, that the problem on this liability business and getting sued, which he said is the greatest fear that doctors have, is that the practice in the United States of putting a dollar value on everything. That if a doctor does something that is really negligent, I mean, he should go to jail for that. Go in jail for 6 weeks, or 6 months, or a year, and not have this constant thing that everything, this is worth $10,000, this is worth $100,000, this is worth
$300,000.
No, because is that true in Germany, that you don't sue somebody for
That's right. In Germany, it's not quite as in West Germany. It's talk about East Germany, it's something very different. You can't sue there as easily. But in West Germany, it's beginning to be somewhat of a problem, but not at all as much as here. And that's the other great issue. You ask, what's all the problems here? But the malpractice situation, indeed, is another one of the great problems. And maybe we should talk to some of the colleagues here who are knowledgeable about the myth America, yes, about the myth in the United States. I think that I have a suspicion that we are all too health conscious. We expect health and we are fearful of suffering. That's one of the reasons why we are ready to sue. Secondly, we are very, now I haven't thought this through very carefully, but we are thinking about ourselves. We are individualists in the United States. We would like things to be done to us that are fair for us alone. And it's also a situation in which we live in an era in which lawyers try to help out the consumer wherever they can, in this instance the consumer of healthcare. And there is a whole horde of lawyers who are who are the nadirs of the medical world, yes, and they help out the poor patient. They write books on, like George Annis at Boston University, the rights of hospital patients, and they make a good buck of suing physicians. In the Albany Medical Center, all of a sudden there appeared a bumper sticker, and it said, support your local trial lawyer, send your child to medical school. And that's very true.
The thought of sending people to prison in place of the dollars would almost eliminate the problem because of the exit chasers, attorneys who...
Yes.
That's a fantastic idea. Now, I'm fairly against everybody going to prison. But
yeah. Well, I remember when my father was very ill in the hospital. He had a ruptured appendix. It was nothing. It was just a minor thing. But it so happened that he got an inflammation of the intestine, and his whole intestine stopped, and he was already in his early 60s at that time, and it just didn't start again for weeks and weeks and months and months, and they were ready to abandon him, and he had glucose strips for all that time, and then finally it did start again, and he is now healthy again. But then somebody told him, you are sued, because they were treating you too late. They were letting you lie in the room too late. Somebody told him, and then he talked it over with us. Now, I was at that time still in my idealistic late teens or early 20s or whatever, and I was outraged at the thought, I remember. I was outraged. Look, I said, the physicians are there to help you. Things can happen in a hospital, and he did not sue. It's a cry for suing. You know, everybody wants to sue everybody else. A mother, a child sued her mother for having the baby. Yes, for having her, for living. The child sued her mother for not aborting her early in pregnancy. That's the kind of situation in which we live, full of paradox. And of course, another situation that runs through the papers is not quite as critical, but a girl sued a hospital for, a girl sued her mother for having her prematurely, and she, of course, had to have heavy oxygen treatment, and as was mentioned before, back there, that causes blindness frequently if you give too high a concentration of oxygen to a premature baby. So indeed, it's a ticklish issue whether you can get this premature baby through. If you give too little oxygen, the baby won't survive. If you give too much, you'll have brain damage and usually damage of the eye.
So this mother's idea for her to sue.
Probably.
Yeah. Why put dollar value on it?
That's right.
I mean, this doctor told me that he knew of a case in Germany where a doctor had made a real error of negligence. Mm-hmm. He went to jail for 6 months. He came back and he practiced with those same people. Mm-hmm. The same practice. Mm-hmm. They were not hostile against him. Mm-hmm. They knew he had not done this deliberately. Yes. It was a human error.
Yes.
But it seems to me we're always out to get the buck. That's and right. The lawyer gets 30% or 50%.
Yeah.
Well, and we don't expect our doctors to be human.
That's
and
right.
To make
That's right.
errors.
That's
they
right.
are not
right.
perfect.
Right.
They make errors.
That's right.